Since the 1800s, Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group has been providing quality service and peace of mind to our clients. With our offices in Burlington, Stowe, and St. Albans, and our Dennis Ricker & Brown offices in Montpelier and Lynnonville, we are here when you need us.
And now WDEV-FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Welcome, everyone, and thank you for joining us today. Well, I promised this yesterday to you all that I'd find some time for calls on some of the hot-button issues that you are interested in. I've reserved the entire first hour for your phone calls. We can talk about issues that I've heard some of you want to discuss. One of them is this issue, this ongoing issue around bathrooms. And it's a big debate that's happening around the country. Should those that identify as a certain sex be allowed to use the bathroom or locker room of the sex that they identify with? Both sides have contacted me. Both sides have strong feelings. Let me know what your feelings are about this debate. And then Burlington College closure. Want to get your perspective on that happening. That's just in the news. Broke yesterday. Was in the news this morning in all the local newspapers. Was on the news last night. Would really enjoy your perspective. And I've seen some criticism also of my decision to interview one of the survivors of Benghazi, where two former Navy SEALs died and the ambassador to Libya died. And I'm going to be doing that at the Vermont GOP convention dinner. I'll address that. And of course, we couldn't go by a day, I guess, without discussing Trump as well. I've had some response about Donald Trump. And then in the second hour, what we'll do is we'll interview Bill Atkinson. I'm looking forward to this interview. Bill's a former Navy SEAL. He's been on this program before talking about various things. But what I'm particularly interested in is to ask him about the recent death of a Navy SEAL candidate in the first week of training. And we'll also talk to him about some of the other aspects of SEAL training and how they may be applied to everyday life in society. But first up, let's talk about this bathroom debate. Again, this is a subject that people have emailed me about that they want to bring up. There's both sides to the story that want me to bring up this debate. So give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let me set it up for you just so that you know what we're talking about. I think you probably do. It's been a widely covered debate, both in Chester, Vermont, as well as locally here in Montpelier. This bathroom debate is about some wanting to identify as one sex and using the bathroom or locker room with the sex that they're identifying with. It's the opposite sex that they're identifying with. For example, if boys want to identify as girls, they would use the girls' bathroom and girls' locker room in a high school. And this was the debate that generated itself out of Green Mountain Union High School in Chester, Vermont. This has been the subject of much debate. North Carolina has passed a law which states that you must use the bathroom that corresponds to your birth sex. And President Obama, over the weekend, on Friday, I think it was, issued an executive order which states that if you identify as one sex, then you can use the bathroom or locker room in schools that corresponds to the sex you identify with. So my question is this. Where do you come down on this debate? If you identify as one sex, even though you are the opposite sex, should you have the right to use the opposite sex bathroom and locker rooms. That is the debate that is going on, and both sides are passionate about this debate. If you have an opinion, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. We're going to be talking about this. We're going to be talking about Burlington College. We're going to be talking about Trump. We always talk about Trump. We're going to be talking about Benghazi as well. So where do you come down? Let's talk about this bathroom debate to begin with. And let's go to Lynette in Greensboro. Lynette, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Thanks, Mike. I have a perspective that goes back 45 years. When I got done with college, I joined the second largest commune on the East Coast. And we had 300 people that were in the commune from in lots of different towns, but we had lots of interesting people come and visit. And one of these people was a fellow who was about 6'6", with blonde hair that was cut in a Dutch boy kind of haircut, with black horn-rimmed glasses, and introduced himself as Lila Clare. And the commune had just built a nice dormitory with great big, nice new bathrooms, and the guys were totally freaked by Lila Clare, and the girls welcomed her into our bathroom, and we had interesting conversations and question and answer and things like that. I mean, this was in 1970. This was not in the forefront of conversation, and this person was so sincere, and I just, you know, all the girls said, okay, makes sense to me, welcome to our bathroom. And I have not looked back since then. I got it.
One of the things, Lynette, that some people will argue is that this becomes a different issue in a girl's bathroom in high school. Do you think there's a difference or not?
Well, one thing I've noticed is in this conversation in the town in Vermont that's having the problem, all the students get it. They are friends with these people. I'm sure they understand the same thing that I understood with Lila Clare, that this is a genuine thing, and this person is your girlfriend, or whatever you want to say.
Mm-hmm.
And they marched and protested because they didn't think it was fair. And I think a lot of it has got to do with fear and not knowing anybody that they can relate to as, you know, the person who's going to be affected by this. And I really think that that's got a lot to do with it. I consider myself lucky for having had this experience 45 years ago.
Lynette, thank you so much for your phone call, and thank you for your perspective as well. Let's go to Rich in Huntington. Rich, what's your perspective on the bathroom debate?
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
That's an interesting thing, and it's a fairly simple argument here because it's two different philosophies. Do you go by anatomy? Do you go by a person's feelings and leave it up to the individual? So really, it's getting down to, is there a societal standard, or does everyone make their own standard?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the clash here.
What do you feel, Rich?
What do I feel? Well, let me bring up I have to side with anatomy. I mean, because for one thing, is it fluid from one day to the next? Am I expressing as a woman today, maybe tomorrow not?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, the fact is, it's something that's an unprovable. And I have to feel that there are really people who suffer from genuine medical maladies that create a genuine dysphoria of their gender and a confusion. But I have to say that probably 29 out of 30 people who are going to get on this bandwagon and call themselves transgender are maybe just people who get off on it and don't really have a genuine... But there, again, it's a disprovable thing. But here's the thing. When you get into high school bathrooms and, you know, things where people are, you know, a principal is making a decision or a governor is making a decision, something like that, that's one thing. What are we going to do in two venues that I can think of where this is going to cause a little confusion? What about registering for the draft? And what about Olympic sports and collegiate sports? If we were going to have, let's say, a college, now we have Title IX that requires more or less equal expenditure between men's and women's sports. When we essentially no longer really have men and women, And you know, according to some people's definition, there are like 50 different genders, depending on how you define it. It's not just two genders and a few that fall between the cracks. But in the Olympics, are they going to go by chromosomes or by anatomy? Or are they going to go, they're going to let a man who really wants to win a gold medal in something compete as a woman? And
Interesting question, Rich. I appreciate your phone call. Thank you. Thank you so much. We're two sides of the debate here, which is an interesting perspective and respectful debate that we're having. The bathroom debate with some when a person identifies as one sex but identifies as the opposite sex, do you allow that person to use the bathroom or locker room with the sex that they identify with? As I said in the beginning, North Carolina has passed a law which states you must use the bathroom that corresponds to your birth sex. President Obama has issued an executive order which states if you identify as one sex, then you can use the bathroom or locker rooms in schools, and we're talking high schools that correspond, or we're talking high schools and higher education in schools that correspond to the sex you identify with. If you don't, he has threatened to withhold federal funds. Let's go. If you have an opinion, you have a comment, you have a question, give us a call at 802-244-1777, toll free at 877-291-8255. I've received emails that people wanted me to bring this issue up on both sides, and we've had calls on both sides, and that's wonderful, and that's what Open Mic is all about. Let's go to John in Callis. John, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning. Your previous caller kind of hit on a point that this whole thing, the way I understood Obama's letter to the schools, there was, I think it was in there, I'm not positive where I heard it, but there were definitions of, you know, like a boy that identifies as a girl that identifies as a boy, and then there was the one that was called gender fluid. And like your caller, previous caller here said, does that mean they identify as a boy one day, a girl the next day? My issue with it is I have 13-year-old girls that have gym class and sports stuff, and they're in the locker rooms changing. And if a boy goes in there one day just to sneak a peek or whatever, and all he's got to do is say, "Well, I identify as a girl today," or "I identify as a girl." How do you regulate it? Or, I mean, how do you keep track? I mean, it just, I think it's too broad, Obama's letter. I think that just is too vague. There's no way to prove or you know. It really bothers me. And the kids down at Green Mountain School, I think the school itself already had 5 or 6 bathrooms that anybody could use. I don't understand what the problem was, you know. And I really don't. I don't see the comparison between this and discrimination against African Americans back in, you know, the 50s, 60s, the segregation. It doesn't, to me, match up.
You know, John, you bring up a very good issue, which is the concerns of the students. How do we handle a situation where a student or even a majority of students may feel uncomfortable with the presence of the opposite sex in their locker room or bathroom? And or do we say their concerns don't matter? Those are sort of the issues this raises and sort of the issues that you raised. Thank you for your phone call, and thank you for raising some of those issues as well. Jerry in Berlin. Jerry, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning, and you just took the wind out of my sail. I waited so long, and all of a sudden, whoa.
I'm sorry, okay. Jerry.
The thing is I that's my point. These kids, these people, these transgender people all have a right to live the life they do. I'm not necessarily agreeing with it, but you know, who am I to say no? My point is if I'm going into a man's bathroom, it says men on the wall, I expect men to be in that bathroom. And I expect my wife, if she says, you know, if she sees women on the wall, that means there will only be women in that room. I know it's going to cost a lot of money. Build them another bathroom. I mean, I do also go to hospitals and places where it says, you know, there's a picture of a girl in a dress and a picture of a man. It's both. You lock the door.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I don't, and I have to bring this up. This is interesting. And I'm not even sure if I want to, but when I was a young man in the early 70s, I wore a ponytail and a beard, and I was called a hippie.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And, you know, it just, now I think, and I did that out of rebellion. I know that now. I did that out of rebellion. And I see a lot of these kids going down the street protesting this issue, and I wonder where they're going to be in 10 years.
Hey, Jerry, thank you so much for your perspective. I appreciate it. Let's go to Rob in North Carolina. Rob, you're on open mic, and we're talking about the bathroom controversy, I guess is the best way to phrase it.
Yeah, good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
You know, that we're using airtime to do this and people's energy on this issue at this time, I mean, it's pretty outrageous. I mean, there's so many other things going on, and it makes one wonder, here in North Carolina where I am, why this gets started in the first place. It's almost a solution looking for a problem, and I think the now that the president has actually weighed in, executive order, the overreach is just so flagrant. I mean, you know, the courts haven't even decided if this is even discrimination, but Barack Obama steps up, you know, praising his own, coveting his own judicial wisdom and says, you know what, it's been decided because I've decided it, so now you're going to have to listen to me and what my opinion is. We don't need to wait for the courts. So, I mean, there's so many different things, so many issues here. That we could be discussing, and we really shouldn't be right now. So this all started in Charlotte, about an hour and a half from here. And from what I've read in the local papers, and, you know, we have a show down here. It's much like, you know, you have one up there on, do you have any more local politics? I don't even know anymore. Well, you have a panel discussing just the local politics up there. They have it down here.
Well, we have selectmen, if that's what you're talking about. We have city councils, if that's what you're talking about. I'm not sure what you were talking about, Rob.
A radio show where they all get in and they have political views for the week.
They do on cable TV, actually, in various locations.
Yeah, okay. So down here they've discussed it quite thoroughly. And so Charlotte used to be quite conservative. Used to have city council very conservative. And Pat McCrory was actually part of that local governor there for a long time, and they never had a problem with this. And Charlotte now is run by, as I understand from the conversations down here, mostly liberals who decided that they were going to make this an issue. And they had to have known that this issue, they say here they predicted what was going to happen, that the conservative legislature would weigh in and countermand this right away, because it does order, you know, not just schools and public places, but businesses would have to, you know, comply with the local ordinance, the city ordinance over there. So, I mean, they got what they expected. But what I really didn't expect is the president of the United States would come in here and try to settle this score for everybody else. This is a touchy issue. I mean,
It certainly is, Rob, and thank you for your phone call on that. It is a touchy issue, and one that both sides feel passionate about, and that's the subject that we're talking about in the first sort of segment of Open Mic this morning. This bathroom debate, as I call it, only because it sort of clarifies what we're talking about, where some people that are that are of one sex identify as the opposite sex or are discovering their sex and using the bathroom or the locker room of the sex that they are identifying by. As Rob had mentioned, North Carolina has passed a law which states you must use the bathroom that corresponds to your birth sex. And that's in response to what Charlotte was doing, which was saying you're allowed to use the bathroom, or I presume, I don't know about Charlotte, but the locker room of the sex you identify with. And President Obama has issued an executive order which states if you identify as one sex, then you can use the bathroom or locker room in schools that correspond to the sex you identify with. If you're a girl and you identify as a boy, you can go into the boys' locker room, you can go into the boys' bathroom. If you're a boy who identifies as a girl, you can do just the opposite. And so I'm asking the question this morning because there are passionate sides of both sides of the debate. Where do you come down on this debate? If you identify as one sex, even though you are of the opposite sex, should you have the right to use the opposite sex bathroom or locker rooms? Be very interested in your opinions. And we've had a flurry of calls here in terms of your opinions. The number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. One of the callers brought up the issue, and it's a legitimate issue, is what are the concerns? How do you handle a situation where a student or even a majority of students may feel uncomfortable with the presence of the opposite sex in their locker room or in their bathroom? If they have concerns, do their opinions matter, or will they be labeled as maybe homophobe if they raise those concerns? Those are some of the issues that we've been talking about. Let's go back to the phone lines, and let's go to Paul in Moncton. Paul, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. Hey, I'm not going to take a stand either way on the issue of whether it's the right thing to do or not. I don't know. I really don't. I'm kind of in the middle trying to come up with my own ideas as to what I think. More importantly, what I would like to discuss for a minute here is the response of the government and the threat of the government withholding dollars from states who don't agree with what President Obama wants to have happen. Because I'm going to give you another scenario, and I'm curious as to what people who supported President Obama's decision would think about this scenario. What happens if we end up with Donald Trump as president? And what happens if Donald Trump decides that he wants to cut off funds to states who educate illegal immigrants who have broken our laws, who have committed a felony to get here, whether they be children or adults? Technically speaking, based upon the decision of President Obama to withhold dollars from states who don't adhere to what he would like to see them do with transgendered students, the same thing could be applied in that case. So the problem I see here is rule of law is really being twisted based upon the whims of individuals, and rule of law should not be held in that kind of a way. And I'm curious as to what you think.
You know, that's a very interesting sort of question that you pose here, Paul. Here's what I think on this issue, and this is an issue that, like you, Paul, I have sort of mixed feelings on. I have three issues that I think need to be sorted out on this whole debate. The first is that this whole notion nowadays, if you have legitimate concerns about a policy, then you're immediately labeled as something. In this case, you would be labeled as a homophobe. If a student had a problem with somebody coming into their locker room, they may be labeled as a homophobe. If you have other opinions about this, then perhaps you're labeled as a homophobe. You know, we had this discussion with the Syrian refugee debate. Now, I happen to be a supporter of bringing Syrian refugees to Vermont, but there are people out there that have legitimate concerns about safety, and yet we had various politicians, including the governor, calling these people racist, and I thought that was wrong because they had legitimate concerns about a public policy. And it's easy for politicians to do that. What they do is label you because they don't want to do the hard work of trying to convince you, to trying to bring in the issues and confronting the issues or confronting your concerns. They don't want to do that. They just want to label you. And I have a problem when they try to do this. In this case, I think, Paul, people have legitimate concerns. And the easiest and most expedited way, I guess, to try and attack them is to label them as homophobes. And I have a problem with that. The second issue is something that Jerry brought up. How do you handle a situation where a student or even a majority of students may feel uncomfortable with the presence of the opposite sex in their locker room? Do their concerns matter? The third issue, and I will freely admit, this is probably a minor an insignificant number of people. But how do we handle those that want to abuse the system, especially those that are criminal or predators? How do we keep them away from our students, or how do we keep them away from individuals? So far, I've seen little attention paid to these legitimate concerns and more attention paid to trying to label people as homophobes. I don't believe they are. I believe they have legitimate concerns, and I think not addressing those concerns just doesn't help in this manner. You know, Jerry, you asked me what I believe in. I believe that we need to find accommodations for those who identify as the opposite sex. And we need to be sensitive to those people who identify that. I have no problem with people that want to identify and use a bathroom or locker room that they feel comfortable with. But there needs to be a conversation to find accommodations for everyone, including those who find this uncomfortable. And it can't be done because one party or the other wants it as a campaign issue. And they both do, by the way. It can't be done in that atmosphere. That is entirely the wrong environment to have this debate because it becomes a political debate. And the purpose of a political debate is to divide and not unite. And in this portion, there are people with strong feelings on both sides of this. We need to unite those feelings. We need to move ahead on this debate. And we need to be sensitive to both sides. That's what I think, Jerry. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Tom, I jumped on the bumper here because we've got these phone calls and I want to make sure that I get to them. We're talking about what I'm labeling as the bathroom debate, which is that some people are identifying that are one sex and are identifying as the opposite sex and requesting the right to use the bathroom or the locker room of the sex they identify with. North Carolina, as I had mentioned, has passed a law which states you must use the bathroom that corresponds to your birth sex. President Obama has issued an executive order which states that you can identify as one sex and use the bathroom in schools, the bathroom or locker rooms of the sex you identify with. That means a girl can identify as a boy, use the boy's bathroom and locker room. A boy can identify as a girl and use the girl's bathroom and locker room. So let's get back to the phone calls and let's go to Holly and Barry. Holly, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Morning.
You're on.
I know. My thinking is this. We got to step away from the emotional part of it. We have to remember that when we grew up, I'm in my 60s, mm-hmm. that there was homophobia. And people who were gay or lesbian were just not accepted and were made fun of and everything. And that was so wrong. And that's really come around to being much more accepted these days. And I think that's great. And I think it's that has happened because the younger generation is much more open and accepting of each other and loving. But as far as a transgendered issue goes, if you've seen on TV those children who are transgendered at a young age, those little girls who identified as a boy and are dressing as a boy, vice versa, got to think of them. And they shouldn't be forced, you know, a little boy who's now a girl because that's the way he was born, and that's what he identifies with, he should not have to go in a boy's bathroom and vice versa with the other. The other thing, too, is people are afraid that some pedophile child or maybe teacher or something is going to go into the alternate bathroom. They're going to, like, pretend, you know, dress up and mm-hmm. pretend that they're transgendered themselves. That's not going to happen. And if that, you know, if a boy, say, went into a girl's bathroom and said he was transgender but hadn't been in his life in the school, then, you know, the school administrator would take care of, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of an issue. Because I think in the long run, bathrooms, I don't know about locker rooms, but bathrooms are all going to have stalls, and they're probably going to be uni bathrooms in, you know, big places like airports and stuff where, you know, I believe they probably do it in other countries because so often, you know, one bathroom's broken down and a person can't access their own and they need to use the facility. So I think that's all going to come in the future, and it's because the younger people these days are just much more open to accepting people for who they say they are and who they truly are.
Holly, thank you so much for your phone call. Let's go to Jean in Barrie. Jean, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning.
You're on.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, I think it's getting to be like down south. Remember how it was? Everything had to be whites only, mm-hmm. against the black.
Mm-hmm.
But one state I heard, I forgot where it was, as trying to figure it out, by anybody can use the bathroom, but one person go in at a time.
Hmm.
You know, and like you go up to the hospital, they don't necessarily have labels. I've seen a person wrapped on the door, see if anybody's there. If not, they go in, and that's it. And so they've got to do something to straighten this out because it's just going, it's something like a racial thing, that one thing or another. You know, there are different things going on, like the whites and the blacks, and now it's transgender against, you know,
right.
The other people.
Jean, thank you for your... for your phone call. I appreciate your phone call. What I'd like to do now, I'd like to switch the subject a little bit because I got a lot of subjects I want to sort of cover in the hour, and we've been talking about 45 minutes on this subject. So let me just switch the subject and get your phone calls about a different subject now. Yesterday, Burlington College has been in the news, and yesterday it was sad to see that Burlington College was closing. You know, in full disclosure, I was brought in about 6 months ago for about 4 months to stabilize the finances there. And it's, to me, it's sad because back in the early 1970s, it was Burlington College who started the concept of reaching out to non-traditional students, including returning Vietnam veterans. And you got to remember the times. I mean, some of these callers had talked about the age in the early 70s. Talking about the time when Vietnam veterans were coming back, they were not welcomed, but Burlington College did welcome them. And it was Burlington College was also ahead of its time in how students learned, much of which is being emulated by many of the colleges here, you know, in Vermont and elsewhere throughout the country. But I must say, you know, I was surprised by this decision yesterday, particularly the bank's decision to pull the line of credit, which is critical in any sort of business or college in stabilizing sort of cash flow, especially when you have a small institution like Burlington College. I was surprised because by all accounts, Carol Moore, the president of the college was said to be heading in the right direction for the college to make it a viable entity. And the bank was fully protected with its loan and its line of credit with the remaining land that the college had. So, you know, many people yesterday in the news were asking Carol Moore, and she didn't have an answer for this, and she's not expected to have an answer for this. Why did the bank pull the line of credit? I suspect that some Bernie supporters might see a conspiracy here and that Bernie is hitting the banks pretty darn hard. And given that Jane Sanders was a past president of Burlington College, you know, to some of the conspirators, this is a payback from the bank. I don't think that's the case in this case, because win or lose, Bernie is going to be one of the most powerful politicians in the United States. So why would a bank want to peeve off Bernie Sanders? There's been a complaint filed and a request for a federal investigation by the vice chairman of the Vermont Republican Party to investigate the college for its original loan, that $10 million loan that it did with the bank, People's United, and Jane Sanders. And there's speculation that the feds are investigating, although both the bank and the school have no comment. And I would suspect that will be their line, even if there was an investigation, and there's no way of knowing if there's an investigation or not. The feds don't talk about their investigations when they are doing investigations. But could the bank, you know, some people have speculated, could the bank have become concerned and decided to cut their exposure because of potential bad press, because of an investigation? You know, only the bank knows the reason. But if that is indeed their thinking, it is wishful thinking, because they will not be able to divorce themselves from any investigation or any fallout from an investigation. But right now, with all the questions that are being asked, the bank looks like the bad guy, and they aren't talking. So my question is this: will this have any impact on Bernie Sanders' presidential aspirations? And I'm going to give you my opinion first, because I don't think it's going to have an impact. And for those that wish to jump on Jane Sanders, if you hammer her for any decisions that led to this failure, or blame her for any decisions that led to this failure, are you going to blame Donald Trump in the same way for his business failures? And when you take great risk, and I think by all accounts, everybody in Monday morning quarterbacking has said this was a great risk that this institution took, you can either expect fantastic success or miserable failure. And there usually isn't any sort of in between. So I have this question: is Bernie Sanders' presidential aspirations, are they dented or changed because of all of this? I mean, this is a national story. It is out there all over the place. My daughter called me from Oregon last night because it's a big story because of the presidential primary. So does this have any impact on Bernie Sanders' presidential aspirations? If you have an opinion, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Burlington College, Bernie Sanders. Does it have any impact on him being president? And that's something that I'd be curious in terms of what your opinions are on that. It's sort of a sad affair all the way around in terms of that college closing, because those students there, you know, they're non-traditional students. They are students that don't fit into the mold, perhaps, but they have a learning environment at Burlington College that attracted some students that needed that environment in order to succeed. So we've been talking about two sort of big issues in the news: the bathroom debate, as I call it, and Burlington College and the closure of Burlington College. If you have any sort of opinions, questions, comments about either of those two, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Just want to sort of clean up the phone calls that are there. Howard, I don't mean clean you up. I meant clean up the phone calls. I'm sorry if that didn't sound right. Howard, how are you?
Yes. Fine, thank you.
You're on.
I'm just calling about the college situation.
Sure, go right ahead.
It's my understanding that they overstated the endowment in order to pay those loans from the bank.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that's a state violation or a federal violation, depending on what whether it was a federal bank or a state bank. And the other comment I had was the Sanders residence in Costa Rica, if that information is correct, was a overseas classroom for that college, and reimbursements for renting that were going back to the Sanders directly. So if that information is correct, I think it does affect Bernie. That,
okay.
That's the comment that I had.
Howard, thank you very much for your call. I want to get one other subject in here before we have to break at the top of the hour. I've seen some criticism of my decision to interview one of the survivors from the attack on the consulate and the CIA annex in Benghazi. It is said that I'm showing my political slash partisan stripes by interviewing this individual at the Republican convention dinner. Let me be clear. I would interview anyone involved in this tragedy, even if it was at a Republican function, at a Democratic function, at a progressive function, or if it was on a park bench. I would interview to try to find out more information of how two former Navy SEALs and an ambassador were killed. I make no apologies for my desire to do this interview. In addition, I can't change what I've done in the past, either working for a Republican governor or in the private sector or my military background. It is who I am, nor would I change any of it. I have no regrets for what I've done. All I can do is provide you with a daily program that is interesting and fair. And I think I do that on a daily basis. If you've listened to me, I've been critical of both sides of the aisle when appropriate. Yesterday it was Trump. Some days it's Governor Shumlin. Some days I've been hard on Republicans when they come in here and talk about various issues. And some days I've been hard on Democrats. The gubernatorial candidates, I have told them that they got one opportunity, and they all came in here and did this, to introduce themselves to all of you, the listeners. And I have told them the second and third time they come in, it's going to be a little bit more difficult in terms of the questions. Some of you were offended that I pushed one of the gubernatorial candidates, Bruce Lissman, when he was here. Others thought I went too light with him. If I did that, I think I hit the right tone that I was going for. I've been critical of both sides of the aisle when appropriate. So criticism coming, I have every intention of doing this interview, and I'm happy to do this interview because I think it's an important interview to do. Coming up, we talk about fascinating interviews. We have Bill Atkinson. He's a former Navy SEAL. He's also a Navy SEAL trainer, and we'll talk about that. We'll also talk about those qualities that happen in training that stay with you in life and how he spreads those, talks about those qualities with others in other sectors, whether it's private sector or the public sector. We'll also sort of quiz him on his thoughts in terms of why a Navy SEAL trainee died just a few weeks ago after just being in training for about a week. So that's some of the things that we're going to be talking about. And I just want to give you a heads up for tomorrow. Tom Messner, the WPTZ meteorologist, will join us in the second hour of Open Mic. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV Radio News on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. And of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to welcome Justin Duckham from Talk Media News. Justin, good morning. How are you? Justin, we don't have Justin.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I have my phone on mute. Great to be here, Mike. How are you?
I am fine. Thank you. You just gave me a heart attack, Justin.
I'm sorry, I did not mean to leave you with some dead air, but I'm here.
Justin, two primaries today. What can we expect?
Well, we have the one in Oregon, which is male only, which is not just that only men can vote. It is a primary that is only being carried out by a mailed-in ballot. That's looking like that's likely going to be Bernie Sanders' territory. And then in Kentucky, we actually have what we are expecting to be a pretty close race this evening. In Kentucky, we haven't really seen much polls publicly in the lead-up to the state, but we have seen some statements from Hillary Clinton essentially expressing confidence that she is going to be doing well there. She's been campaigning very heavily. And typically, when it comes to the expectation games among campaigns, if you are trying to build up sort of expectations, that probably means that you have reason to believe you're going to be doing well. So I would expect that there has likely been some internal polling within the Clinton camp that shows that they're going to be doing pretty well over there. But nevertheless, this could be some pretty treacherous territory. This could be a very close race. We obviously have Bernie Sanders, who has done very well in states like Indiana or states like West Virginia, states that are very close to Kentucky demographically, that have coal interests and whatnot, and that he has previously won. So this could be a very big nail biter this evening.
How does Hillary Clinton overcome her coal statements of the past in Kentucky?
You know, that's a good question, and actually we're getting some kind of insight into that campaign strategy. We had her on the campaign trail earlier this week saying that she is essentially going to be relying on Bill Clinton to revitalize the economy, not just nationwide, but in these states that have been left behind. She sort of mentioned Kentucky like that. She kind of put that in the same category as Indiana and West Virginia or whatnot, and that's sort of an indication that we are likely going to be seeing Bill Clinton deployed more in the sort of Rust Belt states come the general election when that really takes off. And that's sort of similar to what we saw back in 2012. We saw Joe Biden going into states that Obama likely wouldn't be welcomed in very heavily and campaigning there, sort of giving the working class Democratic blue collar appeal and whatnot. And that's something that Clinton has proven to be pretty elegant at in the past, at least more so than Hillary Clinton. So, you know, in states like these, she's probably going to be moving away from those comments by relying on the messenger, one who's more artful on this issue than she is.
Isn't that a double-edged sword, though, because you send your Bill Clinton out, who is a previous president and is your husband. Doesn't that diminish her standing?
It does diminish her standing to a slight extent, but at the same time, it is playing up a strength that the Clintons are well-remembered for. Obviously, you know, that's become sort of a commonplace Democratic talking point that you have a situation where, you know, the Clintons left office and things were doing pretty well, and then the economy collapsed under George W. Bush and whatnot. That's the typical sort of Democratic narrative that they've been trying to put forward for a while. So while this certainly does sort of weaken Hillary Clinton, it does put the more positive impacts of the Clinton administration in plain view. It does open up, however, attacks to NAFTA, but that is something that Clinton has been pretty good at defending in the past when discussing that issue. And so it is a double-edged sword, but one that I'm sure the campaign has done the calculus on and realizes that that's going to probably be something that they can play up to their benefit.
Hey, Justin, over the weekend, the New York Times ran a pretty large story where they interviewed dozens of women who have worked with and dated Donald Trump and observed him interacting with people. They did about 50 interviews, and their findings were that he had unwelcome romantic advances, unending commentary on female form, a shrewd reliance on ambitious women, and an unsettling workplace conduct. This is over a 40-year period that they basically did the interviews. This is coupled with a 25-year-old recording of Donald Trump calling a reporter and claiming to be a publicist. Does this have any impact at all?
That's a good question. And frankly, we have seen Donald Trump go through quite a few scandals. And at any point, if anybody says that it's going to impact him, that typically has generally been wrong. And in this situation, there's a good chance that could be sort of more of the same. But nevertheless, we do know that the Democrats are going to rely heavily upon Trump's unfavorable numbers with women. We've already had a couple of campaign ads being put out by Hillary Clinton that have targeted him for this. Specifically, we have a new one today that features women speaking, doing voiceovers, lip-syncing, rather, statements made by Donald Trump in the past. So this is something that obviously Democrats believe is going to be sort of a sticking factor. And if that turns out to be true, then I would imagine reports like these, and probably much more that we're going to be seeing in a similar vein as this campaign develops, may actually have sticking power. So we'll see how that goes down, but we do know that in general the campaign strategy is going to be from the Democrats to essentially target Trump on his statements against a wide variety of subsections in American life. This includes his your refusal to immediately deny or rebuke the KKK David Duke endorsement, his comments against Muslims, his comments on Hispanics and whatnot. And those are all things that Democrats are obviously going to be relying on to try to drive up numbers and create a coalition similar to what we saw in 2012, when we saw a much higher minority turnout than many people had anticipated and brought the election into a much wider margin than a lot of Democrats foresaw as well.
Now, Donald Trump has retorted and said this is nothing more than a hit piece, and why didn't they do something on Bill Clinton about his alleged affairs? Is that work in terms of a retort?
It is sort of a typical Trump retort, and of course it's probably going to do well among his supporters. This is sort of the obvious, Trump, gusto that we've seen in these kind of situations. He's fired back very heavily. He called the CNN control room yesterday, apparently, when they were doing a report on it, which is a little bit unorthodox for a presidential candidate, to say the least. He has threatened, apparently, to sue the New York Times over this. So he is, going through his usual steps. One that has proven to be pretty effective for a lot of Republican leaders in previous years in terms of going after the media. That's obviously given a lot of Republicans some pretty good shots in the arm to help bolster their campaigns. So I would imagine he would continue the strategy. But it also kind of reflects the fact that Donald Trump wants to have this race both ways. He wants to go after Bill Clinton using sort of gutter politics, using some attacks that a lot of Republicans just haven't used before, such as going after Hillary Clinton, calling her an enabler, but also wants to be treated with baby gloves for, things that he has done with his female employees in terms of, his treatment of them. So it's a, pretty interesting move from Trump. We'll see how that works. But it's sort of also a signal from a lot of people that, if you're going to go down this road with Hillary Clinton, you're also going to have to essentially own up to your own indiscretions.
Hey, Justin, as always, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And that's Justin Duckham from Talk Media News. Up next, Bill Atkinson, former Navy SEAL, now a Navy SEAL trainer. We'll talk to him about a variety of subjects. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to have in our WDEV studios Bill Atkinson. He's a Navy SEAL trainer, but he's also former member of SEAL Team. Bill, nice to have you.
Good morning, Mike. It's a pleasure to be back. Mm-hmm. Spectacular drive down this morning from Burlington. It's very nice to see the transition that's finally occurring. The mountaintops have a little dusting of snow on them, which gives a taste of winter still, but then we've got the shades of emerald coming in. It's really spectacular to see that this time of year.
Boy, you're quite the poet. Where did you get that?
years of training, thousands of dollars, but not associated with that.
Bill, there's been a recent death at BUDS, and BUDS is the Basic Underwater Demolition / SEAL Team Training. It's the basic training for Navy SEALs. In particular, a candidate who died in the first week of training. Can you explain what goes on at BUDS and what are the training phases? And then probably explain sort of how the instructors watch over people and the safety people watch over people as well.
Sure, I can do that. First of all, as you know, Mike, and some of the listeners, perhaps from the last time I was on the radio, spent the last almost 10 years working as a mentor for Navy recruiting. In that capacity, I physically and mentally prepared individuals to pursue special operations jobs, the vast majority of them wanting to be SEALs. So speaking specifically to BUDS, Basic Underwater Demolition SEAL Training, 6 months long SEAL, about the same as when you and I went through, three phases of training preceded by what's called a basic orientation or BO. So the first phase of training is very physical in nature. That's where between basic orientation and first phase all the way up through Hell Week, that's where a lot of the chaff is weeded out. And once Hell Week is complete, those that survive that get a little bit of a rest before they go into the second phase, which is dive phase. And then the final phase of training is the land warfare phase. So, you know, it's still very arduous training. Probably when you went through, about 3 out of 10 enlisted made it through. Same was the case with me, as is the case today. Interestingly, in a conversation with a mentor out in Coronado, California, a gentleman named Louis Lastra, he remarked recently, you know, we have the most fit quitters out here we've ever had. And that's an interesting sidebar. But still very arduous training. There's the three phases, and then you've got probably still, I would guess, the same number of cadre or instructors out there, perhaps more because the classes do actually start with bigger numbers than I think when you and I went through. So speaking specifically to this incident that just occurred, regardless of what the circumstances were, how many people were in that class, how many instructors were on the pool deck or the training tank, as the Navy refers to a box filled with water, which is a swimming pool, a very controlled environment, it's hard to say what happened, but it's disappointing, and here's why. First of all, as you and I both know, anytime you do an evolution as a SEAL or a SEAL wannabe, including in BUDS or SEAL training out in Coronado, you always have a swim buddy. So that's the first line of safety. The second line of safety would be the fact that there's a bunch of other people in the training tank or the swimming pool with you. So if you have a problem and your buddy can't help you, they should be able to help you as well. But then there are the instructors and the staff up on the pool deck, including safety overwatch, medics or corpsmen, as the Navy calls them. So how this happened is, quite frankly, is mystifying and very puzzling. Many years ago, probably about 5 years ago, and I'm tying this into this particular incident, I was working with candidates at a YMCA, and it was fairly early in the morning. There weren't a lot of people in the pool. But there was a gentleman, probably in his early 40s, that was in the pool with us at the same time. And unbeknownst to me or the lifeguard in the lifeguard chair, this gentleman was doing breath hold training. One of my candidates was at the far end of the pool and caused quite a commotion that gained my attention. I thought there was something wrong with him in particular. And he said, no, there's somebody on the bottom of the pool. Sure enough, there was. We brought that man that was doing the breath hold training up to the surface and tried to resuscitate him. He was already gone. What's my point? My point is these things happen. But in training like BUDS, with their long history and tradition and careful overwatch and careful oversight of the things they do. Again, I'm really puzzled that this happened. It's unfortunate, and I really wonder why it did happen. It should not have, in my opinion.
Obviously, there will be an investigation, right. But you were a SEAL mentor, or still are, right? A SEAL mentor. A SEAL mentor is someone that gets somebody ready for BUDS training. And
yes.
And it's actually sort of... it's sort of a pre-qualifying event for people that want to go on to BUDS. You discern whether they go on or not go on. What do you look for in those candidates?
Well, the basic attributes are an individual certainly that's physically and mentally fit. So the baseline would be they've got to be physically fit, and that baseline that we use to assess that is the one that you and I know from years ago, and that's the physical screening test, which is comprised of a timed swim, followed by calisthenics of push-ups, sit-ups, and pull-ups, followed by a timed run. And the standards for that have changed remarkably little. Nevertheless, that's the basic physical part of the assessment. But the mental piece is that's a more challenging part. It's a more esoteric. It's hard to squeeze that out of somebody, especially in the role as a mentor working for Navy recruiting and recruiters who are most anxious to get somebody to commit, sign on the dotted line, get them qualified, and move them forward as quickly as possible to meet the monthly quotas. So I was challenged by that because oftentimes I had to try to ascertain to the best of my ability within a month this person's got the right stuff to do one of these jobs, including SEAL. And if let me speak briefly, there were five jobs. There were SEAL, there were special boat operators, or SWIC, Explosive Ordnance Disposal, or EOD, and Navy Diver, and then Air Rescue. So five jobs, if I were to tier them in terms of degree of difficulty and the individual that needed to have the right stuff to do the jobs, SEAL would be at the top of the heap there. So trying to ascertain that in a month or less sometimes was very challenging. But, you know, a lot of it is physically and mentally fit, got to be smart, articulate, have great work ethic, and a positive mental attitude was another big one that I look for in individuals, assessing them as quickly as possible and moving them forward in our jobs and helping recruiting make the quotas.
Bill, just out of curiosity, can you tell fairly quick who's going to make it and who's not going to make it?
Oh, good Lord, no. The best that that I ever could do, and I don't think that would ever change, would be to say, you know, this individual has all the right attributes to be successful, and they clearly demonstrated that while I work with them as a mentor for 4 to 12 months, and I wish them the best as they move forward. But as we all know, or you and I certainly, once you move forward into these pipelines, there's something for everyone, and there's many different ways that one can get tripped up along the way.
We're speaking with Bill Atkinson, a Navy SEAL trainer, and also we're talking about SEAL Team. We'll get into other aspects of Navy SEALs in a minute, but we're focusing on BUDS training, which is the basic underwater demolition / SEAL Team training. And it's made the news just recently because a trainee in his first week of training died at BUDS training in Coronado. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Tom in Montpelier. Tom, you're on open mic.
Hey, morning, guys. I know you two guys will be slightly prejudiced on this. It's a little sort of off topic. I kind of come in there at the end. I've always wondered what the difference in missions was for the Rangers and the SEALs. Is it just the water component that's different? And I'll just hang up and listen.
Thanks, Tom, for your phone call. I thought he was going someplace else. I thought he was going to say what was the difference between underwater demolition teams and SEAL teams, but he went Rangers. And I don't know if I know the answer to that one.
Well, that's and thank you, Tom, for that question. So on a very basic level, it is the water that distinguishes the two. They're both parts of the Special Operations Command, which is headquartered in Tampa, Florida. Rangers are very good at what they do. They do long-range reconnaissance and patrols. They do a lot of security action. So, for example, let's say that the SEALs were doing a mission somewhere in Afghanistan. They're out doing a direct action mission, and they get inserted somewhere, and then they come back. Now, they may come back and join up with Rangers who support their mission in a capacity of securing an area for them to come back to, for example. That's the short answer. But the other short answer, of course, is that the SEALs, I would say their capabilities are more multifaceted, and they would be the ones called upon to do anything that involved being in, on, or under the water.
Of course, we're biased. Can I ask this? And it sort of allows us. Let's take a break. But when we come back, what I want to turn to the attributes that you think Navy SEALs learn or are taught that may be applicable to everyday success in everyday life. We're speaking with Bill Atkinson, former U.S. Navy SEAL and also a Navy SEAL trainer. We welcome your phone calls at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. As you all know, we've been focusing the month of May up to Memorial Day on those that have served in the military and on those organizations that serve those that are in the military. And today we're speaking with Bill Atkinson, former Navy SEAL, now a Navy SEAL trainer and trainer of other people as well. We'll talk to him a little bit about what it's like. What did you learn in SEAL Team, and how is that applicable in today's society at large? So, Bill, I just asked you the question through the audience. So what did you learn in SEAL Team training, and how is that, whatever you learned in SEAL Team training and SEAL Team, applicable to the society at large?
Well, thanks for that question, Mike. Of course, I learned a lot of things in SEAL Team, but I think probably most importantly is I learned a lot about myself. And I'm going to go back in time a little bit. Graduated high school. My goal was to actually be a classical trumpeter and to go to a conservatory of music or maybe even Juilliard as a trumpet major. Well, that didn't work out.
What about the Navy band?
How about in my company in boot camp, I attempted to play the trumpet, sort of. At that point, I lost a fair amount of skills. Nevertheless, so the piece about the being a classical trumpeter, which, again, was a great aspiration even in high school, that didn't work out for reasons. Tried college. That didn't work out. After 2 years, I told my folks, look, you know, I've kind of wasted my time and your money. Thanks so much, but this isn't for me, and I want to continue on with something else. And so, you know, I moved on and kind of drifted a little bit for the better part of a year. I was actually living up here at the time and said, you know what, I think I'm going to join the Navy to learn a trade. And so I went forward with a guaranteed school, never heard of SEALs. When I was in boot camp, the puffy-chested guys in the tight T-shirts introduced themselves, showed a propaganda film, and I was hooked, and the rest was history. But what I learned about myself going through the SEAL pipeline, going through basic underwater demolition SEAL training, and then being a SEAL for a career and having various jobs that I had to do in various positions of responsibility, is I learned a lot about myself and what it meant to be a SEAL, what's embodied in being a SEAL. It's work ethic, it's integrity. Very simply, there's probably some listeners out there that have heard of Don Miguel Ruiz and the four agreements, the first one being impeccable with your word, the second, don't take anything personally, the third, don't make assumptions, and the fourth, always do your best. And, of course, as we all know, our best varies from day to day. And if you're relating that to buds and being a SEAL, if we're not doing our best every day, going through the pipeline to become a SEAL and then actually being a SEAL, there's a price to pay for that, not only to ourselves but to our teammates if we slip up and we're not doing our best consistently all the time. So that's the sort of things that I took away, and relating that to society today, I mean, that's simple stuff. But, you know, how many of us, including myself, consistently live by that on a daily basis?
What are the reasons, knowing that these are important qualities that you just mentioned, sort of the Navy SEAL ethos and those sort of things. What do you think is the major reason why people wash out of SEAL Team?
Well, that's a great point, too. And a little sidebar to that, for about the past about year now, I've been working with a big-brained PhD psychologist type. And I've always had ideas and thoughts about that, but I never really boiled them down and articulated them. But this gentleman has. And he's actually created a program, a mental conditioning program, that I think, well, first of all, I provided him the opportunity to present that information to special operations candidates, the vast majority of them, as I mentioned, SEAL wannabes. This past winter, he started in February, and he developed six modules and presented that information over three consecutive months to the candidates. And every single one of them, to a person, said, "That was great stuff. I got a lot out of that." So on a very simplistic level, I refer to it as aligning your stars. So a lot of the work that I did with the candidates in the 4 to 12 months that I was with them was physically preparing them. The mental preparation part, I thought I did that reasonably well. But what this Dr. Bill Nash did extremely well and has done extremely well is articulated how to line up your stars, how to mentally, the neck up piece, how to get that right and do everything right from top to bottom, head to toe, before you leave. So certainly, once you get out there, as we all know, there are still going to be things that can trip you up. But, geez, from the neck up piece, that preparation that Bill Nash has articulated and has made available and shared with me as well, it's great stuff.
Well, let me ask you this. I mean, if I remember correctly, and it's been a while, but most of the people that quit in my class quit because of cold water. I mean, they were just freezing. They decided that's enough, and they went and rang the bell. And so how does this sort of mentally help you?
Well, I'm going to use a big term here, and if you're going to ask me to explain it, I'm going to have to turn the microphone down. Bill Nash refers to that as a dissociative state. So let's use this picture, and I think we've actually, if somebody Googled it, they'd probably see it online. A bunch of people in camis or greens with their arms interlocked, wearing orange capox in the surf.
And that's a life preserver.
A life preserver. Laying in the surf, and every one of them, you look at every one of them, and your first impression is, my goodness, they look really miserable. And then you kind of look back at that picture, and there's one person in that group of all those that have their arms linked that's actually smiling. That person has learned what's called the dissociative state. They've learned to embrace the SU blah blah and actually have fun with it. They might be suffering a little bit, just like everybody else is. They might be suffering a lot, but not so much to the point that they aren't able to continue to do what they're doing, that's being cold, wet, and miserable. And in fact, if their mind is in a different place and they're learning to embrace that unpleasantry at that moment, they're in a really good place.
If your body starts shaking uncontrollably, which it oftentimes does.
It does indeed.
In buds. How do you overcome that with that thought process?
Well, that's a really tough one. Now, there are physical ways to do that, and I'm got a very good friend on the Jersey Shore, Don Walsh, quite a guy, has done ultra-long distance open water swims, including around the Isle of Jersey. That's a 41-mile swim. He was swimming continuously for 11-plus hours. The only way to get in the record books for that swim is to skin it. You can wear a swim cap, but that's it, swim cap and goggles and a suit, of course. But so there's that piece, but then the other piece is just to try not to think about it. However, today, that's a hard one to work around, going through the SEAL pipeline.
Mm-hmm. And that's where most, at least in my class, that's where most people tripped up, is the cold water, being cold, being miserable. And it gets to working on your mind. The instructors know that. They continue to work on you once they start seeing that sort of problem developing, and that leads people to go in what is called ring the bell, which is to quit.
That's right. And so related to that point, and probably you and I had this similar experiences, I weighed a whopping 165 pounds soaking wet going through training, and I was in a winter class, which, of course, we all know are the absolutely the toughest classes by far. Right.
I was a January class as well.
Oh, good. But as long as I was moving, I was okay. If I wasn't moving, I wasn't okay. And today, during Hell Week, individuals swallow some kind of a capsule in which is some kind of a sensor, and the medics or the corpsman can actually walk by with a wand and gain your core temperature immediately. So that added safety factor is also problematic for the trainee whose core temperature may be at a point where the instructor or the medic says, hey, we got to pull you out of the problem.
Mm-hmm. What? Let's talk about the ethos that sort of apply to SEAL Team and how they apply to everyday life here in terms of a person trying to be successful. What are those qualities?
Thank you for that question, Mike. And, I'm going to briefly highlight the Navy SEAL ethos or ethos. If one were to Google it, one would find it. But I think the remarkable points about the ethos that relate to society at large are, people that become SEALs, there's a lot of extremely talented people. They have a very talented pool of people to choose from. But there's also a lot of very common individuals that go through that training and become successful. They become SEALs, and they're great SEALs for whatever period of time they serve in the SEAL community, in the Navy, and serving our nation at large. But they're common people with uncommon desires to succeed. So that means they have great work ethic. And, I think relating that to society at large today, that's a really key point. They're accountable. They consider what they're doing professionally to be a privilege. That's a couple of the important points, and there's several other ones. But, relating that to everyday life and society at large today, I think those are important things that are often not really looked at and thought about.
When we come back, I want to talk about how you apply that to either companies or sports teams, and you do that when you're not being a SEAL mentor. Wanted to find out how you do that. How do you apply the concepts of being a SEAL to the civilian world? This is Open Mic. Tom, you caught me by surprise here. I'm sitting here chatting away with Bill Atkinson, who's a former Navy SEAL, now a SEAL team trainer. And one of the things you also do, Bill, is you train others, private companies, athletic teams. What do you tell them? What do you do with sort of private entities that are non-military?
Thanks for that question, Mike. What I am doing is to take some of the things that I learned as a career SEAL, take some of the things that I learned as a mentor for Warrior Challenge candidates for the past 10 years, and translate that and adjust it and adapt it and tone it down and train to a lower common denominator for various entities.
So no Hell Week.
We're calling it Heck Week, or Heck Day, or Heck Afternoon, or Heck Evening.
So, but what sort of things would there be?
Well, what I'm doing is it's action oriented training. So it combines the physical and the mental piece, and I like to take what I call the holistic approach, the heart, mind, body, and spirit to the type of training that I'm doing with individuals and. Entities being organizations, sports teams, groups, people, cross-functional teams from companies, whatever it is. And just talk about the four pillars or four principles that my company Elemental Edge Training is about. And that's accountability, leadership, teamwork, and effective communications. And, what do those things mean? If one were to talk about those things, one would say, oh, yeah, okay, I know what that's about. And, I think I'm a fairly accountable person to myself, both to myself and to others and so on and so forth. But, You know, what I often find certainly in my time in the Navy and in life is that they are, in fact, four pillars. And if one of those pillars is missing, the building totters a little bit. If two of the pillars, those four pillars I've described, are missing, the building goes over.
Mm-hmm.
It falls.
And again, the four pillars are?
It's accountability, leadership, teamwork, and effective communications.
You have an event coming up in June. What is it, and what do you hope to get out of it?
That event coming up in June is myself and Dr. Bill Nash are calling the three-day warrior training. So it's a three-day training that we're conducting at Fit to Excel in Essex Junction. And it is open to any individual that's enlisting in the military to pursue a special operations job. So it's not exclusively Navy. It's all the branches. And as we know, all the services today have a special operations component. And not only that, certainly in the Navy and I think the Army as well, all those jobs are open to men and women.
Mm-hmm.
So
if somebody wanted to sign up for this event in June, how would they do that?
They could certainly go on to my Elemental Edge website, and there's a link on there. If they have a Facebook account and they look me up on Facebook, they could do that as well. That's probably the easiest way is the Facebook page, and then or they could email me at bill@elementaledgetraining. I know that's a mouthful. elementaledgetraining.com.
One of the things that I want to get back to is talking about SEAL Team, and one of the things that there's been a lot of notoriety, a much more notoriety and spotlight on SEAL Team than when we were in.
Absolutely.
Is that good or bad?
It's good and bad. If you were to compel me to make a choice, I would say overall it's probably bad, because I think that anybody that's serving in the military, not the least of which would be special operations types, they should be the quiet professionals. It's better not for people not to know who you are and what you're doing and where and why.
Right? And part of it was instilled, I think it was instilled when you were in, was instilled when I was in, to keep your mouth shut about what you do and how you do it. It seems to me that people are writing books now and doing things which was discouraged, I think, in our day.
And it still is. And you're absolutely right, Mike. And it's actually embodied in the U.S. Navy SEAL ethos. I do not advertise the nature of my work nor seek recognition for my actions. I voluntarily accept the inherent hazards of my profession and place the welfare and security of others before my own. So it is. It's about being the quiet professional. I don't know why, honestly, anybody would want to advertise what they're doing, because it's so high risk. And today the special operations forces in the SEAL, including the SEAL community, are really the tip of the spear. You know, that's how our military is operating these days, in small units doing special things.
Got about 2 minutes left. Going back to BUDS, what was the evolution that you can think of that you struggled most on?
Golly, gee, which one? during Hell Week. I mentioned about 10 minutes ago in our conversation, we were both in winter classes, and as long as I was moving, I was okay. Do you remember the mud flats?
I do remember the mud flats.
We weren't moving much. I fell in love with my shelter half-mate that night. I can still remember the guy's name. He was about 220 pounds of heater, kept me warm through the night. The sun rose, and by my goodness, I was ready to get up and move the next day, but I would not have made it through that night without that warm body next to me, Mike. Yes, yes.
And just the final question. Did you... You know, one of the things that I often remembered is that I would often say, let's just get through this evolution. Let's mm-hmm. just get through this exercise. It wasn't thinking about quitting, but wondering if you can get through an exercise. Just get through the exercise. Don't think way ahead. Is that some of the things that you try to instill in your trainees?
It is. And I want to pump Dr. Bill Nash on that one again as well. And, you know, he's done his homework and his research. and asserted that we got to get beyond that 5% of our capacity and say, yeah, we can do this and we can do much more than we think we can.
Bill Atkinson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Pleasure as always.
That's Bill Atkinson, former U.S. Navy SEAL and U.S. Navy mentor, SEAL team mentor that trains Navy SEALs. I want to thank Bill and, of course, all of you. The first hour of the show was your call-ins, and we had a ton of call-ins. And I thank you so much for your calls. Tomorrow, I'm excited about this, Tom Messner, WPTZ meteorologist, will join us. He will be on the show. And, of course, you can always listen to Open Mic by going on WDEVradio.com and listening and opening the icon, the Open Mic icon there. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV Radio News on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. We're WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. And, of course, we're streaming worldwide, as I said earlier, at WDEVradio.com.
The Open Mic Podcast is brought to you by Hickok Boardman, Dennis Ricker, and Brown.
Find us online at HBinsurance.com. And you're always welcome to visit us on Facebook, in Vermont, online, on the phone. Hickok and Boardman Insurance Group. We are here when you need us.